According to what? How do you know what's your Swadharma? Yeah, this means one's own particular. It's like shortstop, second base. Yeah, according to your position in Varnashram Dharma, particularly. Or as Prabhupada puts it, your psychophysical nature. What is a baseball player anyway, Varnashram Dharma? Is that right? I don't know. Cricket players too? Sunil Gavaskar and those people? Yeah?
Why did Vyasadeva write down his own story?
Why did what?
Vyasadeva write down his own story.
For our information and edification. He tells his own story so we can find out about it. Oh, yeah? Are you going away with the car?
No, but I do not
want. Okay. Good. What is the compromising spirit of Vyasadeva that is directly condemned by Narada Muni? You remember? Yeah? Yeah, that's his big mistake. He did not sufficiently glorify the Lord. Specifically, he talks about a compromising spirit when it comes to compiling the Mahabharata. Yeah. Yeah, he did that too. Yeah, well, in general, his mistakes are... Well, let's just list his mistakes, right? His mistakes, the mistakes of Vyasadeva. How can we talk like this, huh? Or you do it in the authority of, according to Narada Muni, we have to say. there were some shortcomings, right? One, he did not, somebody said that all right, sufficiently glorify Krishna. Okay, what else did he do? I put him down in sins of commission and sins of omission. The things he didn't do, the things you neglected to do, like this, and then the sins of omission, or commission, the things he did that he shouldn't have done. Yeah.
The compromises in the Vedas where people could get sense gratification under religious principles.
Yeah, regulated sense gratification. What does he say is going to happen? What's his prediction? Yeah? Right. So they will hardly remember your restrictions. So you've encouraged, what he says is you have encouraged sense gratification in the name of religion, and they will hardly care for your restrictions. So also he mentions is another thing, in some of the Puranas, worship of the demigods, huh? Which leads to what? Yeah?
Pantheism.
Okay. Did we cover them all? I think that... So then you'll notice that when he specifically mentions the Mahabharata, in the same purport to 15... He says that's too much material topics in the Mahabharata. That's what he says. There are topics of transcendence along with material topics. The Bhagavad Gita is in there. I mean, the Bhagavad Gita, we say, is 700 verses. The Mahabharata? 100,000. Right? Now, there's a few more in there. There's a couple other places which are fairly transcendental, too. But basically, that ratio is he's complaining about that ratio of 700 verses of the Gita to 100,000 verses. What is that? It's 7 to... That's a pretty dilute solution, huh? Pretty dilute. Men with materialistic tendency are more attracted to the politics, economics, and philanthropic activities mentioned in the Mahabharata than to the principal topic, namely the Bhagavad Gita. This compromising spirit of Vyasadeva is directly condemned by Narada. That's what he says, compromising spirit. Okay. All right. Now, we have gone up to text 20. The other thing that we've discussed is Narada Muni's discussion of the glories of devotional service, saying that it's better that people perform devotional service imperfectly than their swadharma perfectly. Generally, the Bhagavad Gita says, better perform your own duty imperfectly than another's swadharma perfectly. But here Narada Muni says, well, it's better to perform Sanatana Dharma or Bhagavad Dharma perfectly, imperfectly, than your own swadharma perfectly. And what's his argument? He says, if you perform your swadharma perfectly, what do you get? Yeah. Enough, what's the use? He says, you stay in the material world. But what happens if you perform, you begin devotional service, but it's imperfect? Yeah.
Krishna directly takes care of you.
You never again, if you begin and at least once get a taste of love for Krishna, like a little bitty, tiny little drop of it, you never again enter the path of samsara in an ordinary way, although you may appear to. That's what he's saying. So it's better that you get that little bit of actual devotional service. That'll do you more good than if you perfectly fulfill all your duties in varna and ashram and don't have any devotional service involved. So that was the argument there that he makes in from 17, 18, 19. So then text 20, he gives him some capsule instructions about what should Srimad Bhagavatam be about, what he wants him to write. And I find these interesting. In text 20, he tells him to describe Krishna philosophically as the absolute truth. And in text 21, he says to specifically describe all of his lila or pastimes. And that's what you see in Bhagavatam. In other words, Krishna in relationship to his energies. We describe him in that way as the absolute truth. So 20, the Supreme Lord Personality of God is himself this cosmos. That means the impersonal feature. The impersonal feature of Krishna is often described in two different ways. One as the impersonal Brahman, and one as the Vishwa Rupa. The Vishwa Rupa is the envisioning of the whole cosmos as a person, but Prabhupada refers to the Vishwa Rupa as philosophized Vishnu. because the cosmic manifestation he refers to as impersonal cosmic situation, because it's the energies. So when it says the Supreme Lord, Personality of God, is himself this cosmos, that's a reference to his impersonal feature, and still he is aloof from it. That's his transcendental personal feature. From him only has this cosmic manifestation emanated. In him it rests, and unto him it enters after annihilation. Your good self knows all about this. I have given only a synopsis. So he wants that completely understood. What is the relationship precisely between Krishna as the absolute truth and his energies? How he is related to his energies. They are also Krishna, yet Krishna is greater than them. The philosophy of Achincha Beda Beda Tattva. There's a few interesting sentences in here I wanted to point out to you in this purport. The Lord is the transcendental form of eternity, cognition, and bliss. And beauty. Excuse me. Eternity, cognition, and beauty. And thus the creation of the energy of the Lord appears to be partially eternal, full of knowledge, and beautiful also. Interesting, huh? Partially eternal. So it has because this is Krishna's nature, that nature is reflected to some degree even in the cosmic manifestation. That's why this material world looks good to us, because it is a partial reflection of Krishna. He also says here, the superior energy, he describes the different energies in the purport. Later on he says, the superior energy is living force, and therefore she is completely identical, meaning the internal potency. But the external energy, being inert, is partially identical. So Krishna has his internal potencies and the external potencies, but the relationship between Krishna and these potencies are somewhat different. So here he describes the external potency as partially identical with Krishna, but not entirely identical, not the way the internal potency is identical with Krishna. So anyway, he wants him to describe Krishna's position as the absolute truth and how he becomes the cosmos and yet does not become the cosmos at the same time. This is very important, how Krishna is to be understood. Then he says, text 21, your goodness has perfect vision. You yourself can know the Supersoul Personality of Godhead because you are present as the plenary portion of the Lord. Right. Understands Vyasadeva's position. Although you are birthless, you have appeared on this earth for the well-being of all people. Please, therefore, describe the transcendental pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, more vividly. That's basically what he wants. And here in the purport, Prabhupada explains that even though Vyasadeva is Kala, he's an expansion of Krishna, he says, but because he is doing the work of an acharya, he has taught us by his own conduct that one must have a spiritual master, and that no matter how elevated one must be, one has to accept direction and even chastisement from the spiritual master. So that's why, that's part of the reason why this pastime is being enacted. Then text 22, which I covered in Bhagavatam class. Learned circles have positively concluded that the infallible purpose of the advancement of knowledge, namely austerity, study of the Vedas, sacrifice, chanting of hymns, and charity, culminates in the transcendental descriptions of the Lord who is defined in choice poetry. So when I'm asking you to explain the pastimes of Krishna, I am actually now asking you to tell the highest thing that there is, the culmination of all knowledge, whatsoever. Okay, so those are his instructions, these three verses, of the content of Srimad Bhagavatam, and telling him how this will make Srimad Bhagavatam the absolutely topmost literary creation possible. Not just literary, any kind of work of knowledge will have to be culminate in come to the point of Srimad Bhagavatam. So we have to work backwards. We have Bhagavatam, we have to take it backwards, take out of Bhagavatam and relate it to whatever is at hand here. But everything is there in Bhagavatam. It just has to be made manifest by the devotees. So, and Prabhupada has said that, you know, scientists can take hints from this purport and how to do their research and so on, because all knowledge leads to Srimad Bhagavatam. So, any questions so far? Yeah, on this. He's described in different ways. And you can take these words like kala and amsha. You can take it sometimes in context, it means a direct expansion, and sometimes it can mean indirect, actually. It depends. In many places, Prabhupada usually refers to Vyasadeva as a Shaktyavesh avatar. Now, there are actually two kinds of Shaktyavesh avatar, direct and indirect. Shaktyavesh means empowered with a particular mission. You can do one thing and do it really well. And so that's a Shaktyavesh avatar. Brahma is empowered with creative a potency to create a universe. He's a specialist. That's what a Shaktyavesh avatar is, a specialist. So Vyasadeva is a specialist. Now sometimes Shaktyavesh avatars are jivas. Usually we use the term Shaktyavesh avatar for an empowered jiva. But there are also direct Shaktyavesh avatars. Like when Lord Brahma, there's no suitable jiva, then Krishna does it himself. So sometimes a Shaktyavesh avatar will not be in the category of jiva. In the case of Vyasadeva, there seems to be different authorities say different things. They say, some say he's a jiva tattva, some say he's Vishnu tattva. And all I can say is, what difference does it make? And it doesn't make any difference. Prabhupada usually describes him as an empowered jiva. But it makes no difference whatsoever, whatever he may be. Because it means, especially Shaktyavesh avatar, he in that particular area, he's empowered to function as good as God. So, there's no loss.
In text 19, in the purport, it says, the fruited workers want to lord it over the material world. Similarly, a neophyte devotee foolishly thinks of accumulating some material power in exchange for devotional service. Such foolish devotees are sometimes put into difficulty by the Lord. Can you explain that?
Mm-hmm. As a special favor, he may remove all material paraphernalia. It makes him poor, for example. He has performed devotional service, and because he's performed devotional service, he has actually got some power or authority or worship or opulence has developed, and so Krishna will pull the rug out from under him. That's a special favor. Prabhupada himself claimed that Krishna made me a poor man. You know, what he said was, Krishna made me a business failure. That's what he said. Prabhupada said, I had the intention of making a lot of money and using it to spread Krishna consciousness, but Krishna had different plans and he made me a business failure. And his family turned against him, and Eventually, he just gave the whole business up. So, there's a verse in Bhagavatam, which right now it doesn't come to my head. The Krishna shows his special favor to devotees. I'll find it for you later. By taking away some things they may have gathered and become attached to.
So even if you use your material facilities or whatever in your devotional service, if you attach to them, you still take.
He might. If suddenly the things that were on one point something that was the actual helped you make advancement in Krishna consciousness, that same thing may suddenly hinder you, because now you're using that facility for sense gratification or enjoyment. So then it no longer helps you advance in Krishna consciousness. It's become a stumbling block, even though before it was something that helped you. So then Krishna, if he's very merciful, he may take it away. Yeah. Watch out. Somebody else in there? Anyone else in this part? Okay, well, we want to go on to the next section here. We start here with text 23. Narada Muni tells his how I came to the movement story. I said we always had the tradition of when you preach to somebody, finally to illustrate the potency of Krishna consciousness, devotees will often explain how I became a devotee. So here we have the prototype of such stories. Narada Muni. In the last millennium, which means the last Brahma. Not the last Yugasai, but the last Brahma. I was born as the son of a certain maidservant. So this means that two things. First of all, his mother was Shudra category, cleaning lady, maidservant. And second of all, there's no father. He was born out of wedlock. But you'll see there's no father. He was completely, when his mother died, he was all by himself. So there's no father in evidence here. Right? So in other words, he had no qualifications by normal Varnashram Dharma standards. Remember, there's one theme that is running through this. This is for the common people, people who are not elevated, people who are not qualified. That's why he's telling his story. This is how I started out. I was the son of a maidservant. And it so happened that there were some Brahmins who were following the principles of Vedanta. When they were living together 4 months of the rainy season, I was engaged in their personal service. So that was Chaturmasya. In other words, these sannyasis or renounced devotees were usually wandering about, Parivrajakacharyas or Paramahamsas. They didn't have any fixed residence. But when the rains come, you can't travel anymore. The roads are impassable. And so what's done then is one stays in one place for that period of time while the rains are coming and then as the land dries, and follow very strict vows. So that's what they were doing. They were living together in some cave or something like that. And to just do some menial service, cleaning or whatever, his mother was engaged. And so he had the opportunity to get their association by this accident. He was the son of the most insignificant parentage. Right? He was not properly educated, etc., etc. But he became an immortal sage. Let me point out here that the illusion of Maya is at once dissipated as soon as one's full energy is converted in the service of the Lord instead of sense enjoyment. So one has to actually increase his engagement in Krishna service until it's 100%. The first 100% engagement, the illusion is over. So you have to work up, you know, 40%, 50%. You think you're fully engaged, but then Krishna finds out how you can do more, and you do that, and you think you're fully engaged, and Krishna finds out how you can do more. So it's a process of surrender. We always think, now I'm fully engaged, but it turns out we're not. Now, this is often our experience. And here comes another theme of this passage, huh? Of this part. The service of the Lord begins with the service of the Lord's bona fide servants. This is his connection with Krishna. We are talking about connecting with Krishna. This is where the connecting link starts. The Lord says that the service of his servants is greater than his personal service. The service of the devotee is more valuable than the service of the Lord. One should therefore choose a bona fide servant of the Lord, constantly engaged in his service. Accept such a servant as the spiritual master and engage himself in his, the spiritual master's, service. By service of the bona fide spiritual master, the Lord consents to reveal himself in proportion to the service rendered. So that's how it works. No, we were talking earlier, we had some verses about seeing everything in relationship to Krishna, seeing Krishna in everything, and pantheism, and utilization of the human energy in the service of the Lord is the progressive path of salvation. The whole cosmic creation becomes at once identical with the Lord as soon as service in relation with the Lord is rendered under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. The expert spiritual master knows the art of utilizing everything to glorify the Lord, and therefore under his guidance the whole world can be turned into the spiritual abode by the divine grace of the Lord's servant. So the process, devotional service, is the process of transmuting matter into spirit. That's what he's saying here. It can be seen as it actually is spirit, but the illusion of matter has arisen because of our activities of sense gratification. As soon as we connect to Krishna service through the servant of Krishna, then the world begins to change. And it becomes manifest as none different from Krishna. And it says, the spiritual abode. And Prabhupada makes these points about the nature of devotional service. Over and over again through this chapter, these points are made. It'll come up again. Narad Muni was a little boy at the time. He was not so well qualified. Although they were impartial by nature, those followers of the Vedanta blessed me with their causeless mercy. As far as I was concerned, I was self-controlled and had no attachment for sports, even though I was a boy. In addition, I was not naughty, and I did not speak more than required. So here he had some good qualities also. He had something serious about him. The interesting thing that happens here, Prabhupada does something that's pretty amazing. These people, the followers of the Vedantists, or the Vedantavadis, Prabhupada calls them, indicate the pure devotees of the personality of Godhead. Certainly these were not impersonalists because they were always hearing and chanting about Krishna. So they were, as Vedantists, they were not impersonalists. So Prabhupada says, such Vedantavadis, or the Bhakti Vedantas, are impartial in distributing the transcendental knowledge of devotional service. To them, no one is enemy as friend, no one is educated or uneducated. In other words, he was there, he was serving them, and they just gave him devotional service. The Bhakti Vedantas see that the people in general are wasting time in false sensuous things. Their business is to get the ignorant mass of people to reestablish the lost relationship with the personality of Godhead. By such endeavor, even the most forgotten soul is roused up to the sense of spiritual life. And after thus being initiated by the Bhakti Vedantas, the people in general gradually progress in the path of transcendental realization, and so on. So that's, Prabhupada puts this in way back in the early 60s before he had come to America and used his title as the general title for devotees. And here you can see a foreshadowing of things that were to happen. That was what Prabhupada is doing with this Gita, is the same thing, with this Bhagavatam, is the same thing in a different context that these people were doing. They were sitting and glorifying the Lord, and as a result, anyone who happened to come into contact with them, here this little illegitimate son of a maidservant, he got their full mercy. It says here, by eating the remnants of the food. The devotees who serve Krishna like this, they have what is called bhakti shakti. The only way we can get bhakti shakti is from them. Something happens that is transcendental and mysterious and not simply a rational process of learning. And we get bhakti shakti principally, it says, by eating food of such people, touching their feet, taking the dust of their feet. Bhaktivinoda Thakur refers to that in Harinam Chintamani. That's how we get bhakti shakti. So, and Prabhupada talks about getting infected with devotional service. You know, you eat the remnants of somebody who has flu, you get flu, you get infected. So, the same way, we can get infected with Krishna consciousness by this association. And that's what he says. Once only by their permission I took the remnants of their food, and by so doing all my sins were at once eradicated. That was the effect, immediately. It's past karma, parabdha karma. Thus being engaged, I became purified in heart, and at that time the very nature of the transcendentalist became attracted to me. Let's see if I can find that passage. I forgot to mark it. Let me see here. I'll look for it later. Well, anyway, that's what he says. I don't know where it is now. Prabhupada says in the purport, such remnants may be taken even without permission. Narada Muni asked permission, he says, but actually he didn't need to do that. There are many things which hinder one from entering devotional service, but by the association of pure devotees, all these obstacles are removed. The neophyte devotee becomes practically enriched with the transcendental qualities of the pure devotee. Like that. So he goes on. O Vyasadeva, in that association and by the mercy of those great Vedantas, I could hear them describe the attractive activities of Lord Krishna. So he served them, got their association, ate the remnants of their food, and listened to what they were talking about. Thus, listening attentively, my taste for hearing of the personality of Godhead increased at every step. Let me call your attention to a sentence in the purport here. Men are naturally apt to hear histories and narrations of various personalities performing mundane activities. You know, the biography of, Jim Morrison Brian Wilson recently wrote one too, and so people buy these books, volumes and volumes of literature on this stuff. So Prabhupada says, what is wrong with such literature? He says, without knowing that by such association, so actually one is associating with such people, even at one remove on the pages of a book. So what happens to us by such association? One, you waste valuable time. I mean, you could be doing something else, Krishna conscious, but instead this is happening. So you waste valuable time. Unless, of course, it's your service. Somehow or other you have to go preach to, Jim Morrison is dead, but Brian Wilson or somebody, you know. Okay, you waste valuable time. And also, two, one becomes addicted to the three qualities of mundane nature by reading such things. So he calls this an addiction, addiction to the mode of goodness, passion, and ignorance. So it's like that, you know. It's just like people that take a little heroin, but you can get addicted. But very much more addictive is the three qualities of the material nature. And in fact, we've all been addicted. You know, so we're basically like, you know, permanently recovering alcoholics who can never take a drink because as soon as you do, boom, you're right back into it. Until one is very, very advanced, one has to be very, very, very careful because of that previous bad association. So Narada Muni is now explaining how gradually, by this association, he is becoming increasingly purified. And he begins to get a taste for hearing about Krishna. As soon as I got a taste of the personality of Godhead, I'm text 27 now, my attention to hear of the Lord was unflinching. And as my taste developed, I could realize it was only in my ignorance that I had accepted gross and subtle coverings for both the Lord and I are transcendental. So Prabhupada says, by ignorance only, the conditioned soul wrongly thinks that both he and the Lord are products of material nature. In other words, he thinks that the conditioned soul thinks, I am my body, and the Lord's body is material. That's what he means when he said, I had accepted gross and subtle coverings, both the Lord and I are transcendental. So in the material state, one thinks, I am this body. And then when he hears about the body of the Lord's body is material. So one has to realize, I am not this body, and the Lord's body is spiritual. And again, Prabhupada here returns to this theme of engaging everything in Krishna's service and therefore seeing everything in relationship to Krishna. When ignorance is removed and it is perfectly realized that there is nothing existing without the personality of Godhead, then nescience is removed. So nescience, again, is the separate vision. Since the gross and subtle bodies are emanations from the personality of Godhead, the knowledge of light permits one to engage both of them in the service of the Lord. So that's what we can do. There are philosophies, you know, who see no connection between God and the world. Or you're not quite sure what the connection is. Like here it says that this world emanates from Krishna, and therefore it's connected to him in a substantial way. This is stated philosophically that Krishna or God is the material cause of the world or the substantial cause of the world. But in Christian teaching, sometimes it is said that God creates the world ex nihilo. You know that? It's created out of nothing. Now, any descriptions I have tried to read where Christian theologians have tried to explain this, it always ends up sounding just like emanation. Sometimes Christian theologians will deny this emanation is there because it says different things like it will cause a change of God, in God, the world emanates from him, which have already been dealt with in the Vedic literature. So it actually, it emanates from Krishna and therefore is part of Krishna. And therefore, it is possible to reconnect. But this ex nihilo actually kind of constructs an artificial barrier where the world will never actually be connected or redeemed because it's fundamentally, substantially disconnected. So that vision of a disconnected world is also part of some tinge of illusion there. That's where it comes from. Okay. Any questions so far? Thus, during two seasons, the rainy season and autumn, I had the opportunity to hear these great-souled sages constantly chant the unadulterated glories of the Lord Hari. This is how we know they're devotees, right? They're not Mayavadis. As the flow of my devotional service began, the coverings of the modes of passion and ignorance vanished. That we should see, that the clinical sign of advancement of Krishna consciousness is the modes of passion and the modes of ignorance begin to disappear. One should stop being nervous, apprehensive, lazy, sleepy, agitated, so on. Prabhupada comments in the purport toward the end. The flow of devotional service is so potent that any onlooker also becomes liberated. Somebody is just standing around watching. They get caught up on the description like a flow. Devotional service just begins to spring out and it starts to go. And just the bystanders become caught up in it. Any onlooker also becomes liberated from the influence of the modes of passion and ignorance. These two qualities of nature are thus removed, and the living being is liberated, being situated in his original position. I was very much attached to those sages. I was gentle in behavior, and all my sins were eradicated in their service. In my heart, I had strong faith in them. I had subjugated the senses, and I was strictly following them with body and mind. The Prabhupada said, here are the qualifications of a progressive disciple. Everything is there. As they were leaving, those Bhakti Vedantas, who are very kind to poor-hearted souls, instructed me in that most confidential subject which is instructed by the personality of Godhead himself. Remember we talked about confidential knowledge? Here it is. Gyanam guyattamam yattat. So finally when they were leaving, they were packing up in time to wander on, you know. Then they instructed me, shakshat bhagavata uditam, that secret confidential knowledge which is given by the Lord directly himself. Because kipaya dinavatsalaha, by their causeless mercy, and because they're dinavatsalaha, very kind to the poor and meek. Prabhupada first says that a bhakti vedanta instructs followers exactly according to what Krishna has said. Therefore, you can trust what they say. And Prabhupada says the first thing mentions here is that simply what is the position of Krishna? That he doesn't come into being and go out of being. That he's there before the universe. That he's there during the creation. And he's there after the creation. That's what we have to know about Krishna. This is one of the four essential verses of Srimad Bhagavatam that is given by Lord Brahma to Narada Muni earlier. Later in the text, it's in the second canto, but earlier in time, Brahma gets Srimad Bhagavatam in four essential verses to Narada Muni. And one of them, Krishna says, Brahma, it is I who existed only before the creation. And during the creation, while everything is manifested, I still exist in my transcendental abode. And afterwards, when the whole creation is wound up, I am still there. So we see that everything else, you know, comes into being, lasts for a while, and goes away. Krishna is always there. Huh? So, if one actually understands that about Krishna and accepts it in his heart, you're a liberated soul. That's what Prabhupada says, yeah. Yeah. It is I only, right. Because all those other things are also part of Krishna in a manifest stage. This answers the objection of the Mayavadis that the absolute truth is one without a second. So how can there be a creation? Here's the absolute truth, huh? Ekam ek... What is it? I've forgotten it. Ekam eva adityam. Huh? It's defined like that. That besides which there is no other. One and one alone. Absolutely. As soon as there's two, then there's relativity, relationship. So then we have Krishna and Krishna's energy. Doesn't that make Krishna relative? No, because he includes his energy, so there's nothing but Krishna. Yet nothing is Krishna, save and except his own primeval personality. And that's how it works. So Krishna, the world is manifest, is not manifest. Krishna is always there. And there's nothing but Krishna in all these different phases. Yeah? Brahma? Yeah, I don't know what deal they'd worked out. I don't know. I haven't heard about it. Where were we? Okay. Oh, yeah, this transcendental knowledge, this secret knowledge. The word most confidential is significant here because knowledge of devotional service is far, far above knowledge of impersonal Brahman. So here we have this threefold division that Prabhupada gives, which is first just knowledge, jnanam. Jnana. He says, jnana means ordinary knowledge or any branch of knowledge. This knowledge develops up to knowledge of impersonal Brahman. And that's a fact. Actually, I'll tell you, if you take any branch of knowledge and you just pursue it from first principle to first principle and first principle, you end up being a Mayavadi all the time. So it means any knowledge but up to and including an impersonal Brahman. That's jnanam. Above this, when it is partially mixed with devotion, notice it says partially, such knowledge develops to knowledge of Paramatma. So there's a little jnanam plus a little bhakti, shakti, huh? Then you get, call this confidential jnanam, and then you get impersonal Brahman, so that you can call that confidential. Then sometimes he calls this more confidential, up to super soul. Such knowledge develops to knowledge of Paramatma, or the all-pervading Godhead. This is more confidential. See, that's right. He says more confidential. But when such knowledge is turned into pure devotional service and the confidential part of transcendental knowledge is attained, it is called the most confidential knowledge. So that's just pure bhakti here, huh? Or unalloyed bhakti. So this is what's being referred to here in this verse by this secret knowledge. A clear presentation of pure bhakti devoid of any of mixture of jnana. This most confidential knowledge was imparted by the Lord to Brahma, Arjuna, Uddhava, etc. That's what he's referring to there. The most confidential knowledge. That's what it means. And then, by that confidential knowledge, I could understand clearly the influence of the energy of Lord Sri Krishna, the creator, maintainer, and annihilator of everything. By knowing that, one can return to him and personally meet him. Prabhupada says, the Lord desires, as he has directly said in the Bhagavad Gita, that all conditioned souls rotting in the kingdom of material energy come back to him by giving up all engagements in the material world. This is the most confidential part of knowledge. So here he understands the influence of the energy of Lord Sri Krishna. We have to understand that also. Huh? This is the difference between the material energy and the spiritual energy. We have to understand Krishna, and we have to understand Krishna's energies. Huh? And we have to understand them in a practical way. Because our idea is to get out from under the influence of the external potency. So we have to know what is the external potency and what is the internal potency. The external potency, in either case, we are underneath the guidance or direction of one of Krishna's energies. We are being conducted either by the external potency or by the internal potency. This is because it is our constitutional position to be the servant of Krishna. When Prabhupada says constitutional position, the word is used is swarup. Swarup means essence. It means you can't change it. So the essence of the jiva is to be the servant of Krishna. That means we are under Krishna's control, specifically under the control of Krishna's energy. We don't have the freedom not to be controlled by Krishna. What happens to us when we decide we don't want to be controlled by Krishna? Do we, in fact, leave existence? I mean, to not be controlled by Krishna means two things. Either we become Krishna ourselves, or we cease to exist. We just disappear from reality. Well, we can't become Krishna himself. We cannot cease from existing. So what happens when we decide we don't want to serve Krishna? We don't want to be conducted by Krishna's order. We get conducted by Krishna's order by the external potency. We don't understand that we are being conducted by Krishna's order anymore. We are conducted by an energy that befuddles us. It bewilders us as to what's actually going on. So we think, now I'm free, now I'm independent. Look at this material world. This is a place of opportunity. I can be anything I want to be. Right? I can do anything I want. Yeah? Because he's already got the job. The job of Krishna. I mean, Krishna doesn't have to do anything that's... Because if you become the Supreme, then you stop being you. And he can do that. He can absorb you into the Brahma Jyoti. But but then your existence is not manifest as an individual. It's not necessary to, you know, Krishna has to kill himself and make me God, right? That's like demanding the Krishna. Krishna, you can do anything, so I want you to make a married bachelor. Well, what is a married bachelor? You want to tell me what that is? It's a logical contradiction. It doesn't exist. It's a string of words. It's nonsense. You know. So he's not obliged. And unless he could figure some clever way that you could be both married and a bachelor at the same time. It's a little trick. It'll be a tricky thing, you know. But to really do it, make a figure that's simultaneously a square and a circle. You know, I mean, these things are just garbled ideas. So I would say that the fact that Krishna cannot commit suicide and install me in his place is not a reflection on his lack of potency. It's a reflection of our lack of clear thinking. Yeah.
A person who's engaged in full devotional services under the control of the internal potency, does that still mean that the modes of nature have no effect on?
That's right. He's not affected by the modes of nature. That's what it says. That's what transcendental means. Where does the impetus to our actions come from? It comes from the order of Krishna. How do we receive the order of Krishna? From the spiritual master. So if I have to be conducted by the potency of Krishna, it's a question of where my orders are coming from, or the motive for my action. If I perform any action, there has to be a motive for doing it. What is the reason I am doing this action? Is it to satisfy lust, greed, or anger? Or is it to satisfy the order of the spiritual master and of Krishna? If it is to satisfy lust, greed, and anger, then I am under the control of the external potency. If it is under the order of the spiritual master, then I am conducted by the internal potency.
So a person that's engaged in devotional service, they don't get
Well, not really. If it's being done for Krishna, then even though, like Arjuna, he may be as a warrior naturally situated in the mode of passion, and Krishna wants him to act according to his psychophysical nature, but because he's doing that in pure devotional service, even though the mode of passion may be acting, he is not affected. He's not creating any karma, and he's actually not doing it by the push of the mode of passion. He's not doing it to gain the kingdom. He's not doing it to destroy his enemies. He's not doing it because he wants to be a great warrior. He's doing it for one thing only, just to satisfy Krishna. So Krishna, when someone becomes a pure devotee and follows Krishna order, Krishna may work with the material system, but the devotee is actually not conducted by that system. So it may appear that a pure devotee may sometimes function in the modes of material nature, but it's not the case. Yeah.
This is about what about a neophyte
devotee? Neophyte devotee, you know, he has his good days and his bad days. He goes back and forth. Yeah. Sometimes this, sometimes that. Has to make up his mind. Oh, if he's a sincere devotee, Krishna will also use the material energy to rectify the devotee. It says, if one is actually decided that I want to surrender to Krishna, but then there are so many impediments and shortcomings and weakness of heart and these things stop me, still Krishna is working to bring that devotee further and further and further. And so he does not undergo the ordinary course of punishment. Although it may look like it. Then we just read about that. Narada Muni said it doesn't. It's not actually what happens. Okay, you have a last question this time to stop.
Where is the
second canto. It's called... the chapter is called Answers by Citing the Lord's Version. There's four verses in there. I can't remember the number of the chapter and verse number right now. Okay? Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.